Nibbana, as described in Udana 8. There is without birth, without beings, without made things, without fabricated things. Udana 8.3. What is this Nibbana, Nirvana that we spoke of in the previous chapter? What does it look like? In this and the next two chapters, we will look at several suttas that give hints as to what this is and how to approach it. The first several suttas come from the Udana. The Udana is a collection in the Khuddaka Nikaya, the same volume in which you find the Sutta Nipata. Udana means exclamation or inspired utterance, and all these suttas have a prose part. Then at the end of each prose part, the Buddha utters an exclamation, which is always in verse form. At times, scholars indicate that some of the verses were probably composed earlier than the prose parts. For some of the suttas, the prose is a very nice lead-in to the verses. For some of the suttas, there seems to be very little relationship between the prose and the verses. Sometimes the verses are very, very good, even though the lead-in had nothing to do with them. For the suttas from the Udana, we'll discuss in this and the next chapter, the lead-in prose and the verses do fit quite well together. First is Udana 8.1. Thus have I heard. Once the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, on Apindika's Park. On that occasion, the Blessed One was instructing, rousing, inspiring, and gladdening the bhikkhus with a Dhamma talk connected with Nibbana. Those bhikkhus, being receptive and attentive and concentrating the whole mind, were intent on listening to Dhamma. Then, on realizing its significance, the Blessed One uttered on that occasion this inspired utterance. There is, bhikkhus, that base, where there is no earth, no water, no fire, no air, no base of infinite space, no base of infinite consciousness, no base of no thingness, no base of perception nor non-perception, neither this world nor another world, nor both, neither sun nor moon. Here, bhikkhus, I say there is no coming, no going, no staying, no decreasing, no increasing, not fixed, not movable. It has no support. Just this is the end of dukkha. The first thing here is no water, earth, fire, air, no four elements. Then, no four higher jhanas, infinite space, infinite consciousness, no thingness, neither perception or non-perception. So, no rupa and no arupa. It est no materiality, no immateriality. Neither this world nor another world nor both. It's not this world, it's not someplace else, and it's not both this world and someplace else, neither sun nor moon. Here, bhikkhus, I say there is no coming, no going, no staying, no decreasing, no increasing. Not fixed, not movable, it has no support. Just this is the end of dukkha. It seems to be without opposites. It's an experience of, to use a word we use in modern times, non-duality. Thus, the Buddha is describing Nibbana as non-dual. What does that mean? Well, that's the whole sutta, so keep this non-duality in mind, and we'll continue to explore. In the same collection, at Udana 8.2, again the Buddha is at Savatthi giving a Dhamma talk on Nibbana. The prose is exactly the same as the previous sutta, and then the Buddha gives this inspired utterance. The uninclined is hard to see. The truth is not easy to see. Craving is penetrated by one who knows. For one who sees, there is no thing, nothing. That is John D. Ireland's translation. Tanisaro Bhikkhu has, it's hard to see the unaffected, for the truth is not easily seen. Craving is pierced in one who knows. For one who sees, there is nothing. The key point is that there is no thing. But remember, this is not the base of no thingness, which is not the same as the seventh jhana. This is something quite different, and it's very hard to see. It's hard to see the unaffected or the uninclined. It's hard to rest your mind in this non-dual state. So far, this has not really led to a lot of understanding of what Nibbana is. The problem we encounter in the sutta descriptions of Nibbana is that they are all rather cryptic. This is due to trying to describe the indescribable. Mostly all the Buddha can do is hint at what Nibbana is not. Udana 8.3 is probably the most famous description of Nibbana found in the suttas. Again, the Buddha is at Savatthi, giving a Dhamma talk on Nibbana. The monks are listening, all the same as before, and then the Buddha gives this inspired utterance. There is, bhikkhus, a not born, a not brought to being, a not made, a not conditioned. If bhikkhus there were, no, not born, not brought to being, not made, not conditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, brought to being, made, conditioned. But since there is a not born, a not brought to being, a not made, a not conditioned, therefore an escape is discerned from what is born, brought to being, made, or conditioned. You might have heard of nibbana referred to as the unconditioned. Both words are wrong in such a translation, both the and unconditioned. Pali doesn't have any articles. There's no a, an, or the. Another translation only says there is an unborn, unmade, unbecome, unfabricated. There's still that an at the front of it. This a, an, or the creates a tendency for us to think of it as a thing. This leads to people thinking of the unconditioned or an unconditioned as having ontological existence. That is, it's a real thing. The tooth fairy does not have ontological existence. It's just a concept. Your body does have ontological existence. It's not just a concept. Some people would like to make nibbana an ontological thing, something that truly exists. We even find some contemporary people basically talking about nibbana as another heaven. It is not one of the 31 realms of existence described in some of the later suttas, but it is said to be out there. And furthermore, when one becomes fully awakened, one can enter into it. The thought often expressed seems to be that when one dies as an arahant, one gets to go live there forever. Thus, nibbana has been converted into something very much like the Christian idea of heaven. This is not what the suttas are saying at all, but this mistake seems to arise due to inaccurate translations. The mistake results from the unconditioned. As was pointed out in the previous chapter, there's a very serious problem with giving nibbana ontological existence. Nibbana doesn't change. If nibbana is a thing or a place and it doesn't change, and it doesn't include you right now, you're on the outside forever, because it ain't going to change to let you in. You better hope nibbana doesn't have ontological existence, because unless you're fully awakened right now, unless you're fully within nibbana right now, you're stuck on the outside. Making it seem to have ontological existence by adding the is a source of much confusion and immortality project creating. Unconditioned is the common translation of the word asankata, but unconditioned makes it seem like nibbana is not dependently originated. However, as pointed out in the previous chapter, Nagarjuna makes an excellent case that nibbana is also empty. This matches Dhammapada verse 279, which says all Dhamma, which includes nibbana, are anatta, literally not self. Since Dhamma includes all phenomena, whether alive or not, anatta more generally would mean coreless or without an essence, or empty, thus dependently originated. So unconditioned is exactly the opposite of what asankata means with respect to nibbana. More on this point follows. The initial A in asankata means not or without, and sankata is the past participle of the verb form associated with sankhara. Remember that a sankhara is something that is created, or made, or fabricated, or concocted. Better translations of asankata, rather than unconditioned, would be Tanissara Bhikkhu's unfabricated and Santakaro's unconcocted. These are really good, because who's the concoctor, fabricator? We are. We're busy concocting the things of the world. We're concocting some chunks of wood all stuck together as a table, and when we concoct a table, we miss seeing the trees and the sunlight and the rain and the minerals in the earth and the birds that lived in the trees and the insects that were eaten by the birds and the woodsmen that cut down the trees and somebody who milled it into the form of the table. But it may come to pass that you need to concoct it as something other than a table. What if you desperately need some firewood? You could concoct it as a source of firewood rather than a table. If there's a flood, it might become a raft. We definitely have this tendency to conceive of things in a certain way, and we fixate on them as though they are and were always like that. Asankata, unconcocted, unfabricated, would be not doing that, not fixating on concepts. Literally, this Pali description of nibbana would translate as without birth, ajata, without beings, abhuta, without made things, akata, and without form things, asankata, as opposed to our usual way of experiencing the world with birth, beings, made things, and form things. Does this remind you of the non-duality we found in the verses of Udana 8.1 just above? When you look at the universe, you find everything is dependent on other things. Nothing exists independently. Earlier, we saw that there really aren't any nouns. It's all verbs. It's just that some verbs are moving kind of slow. Even further, it's not actually a bunch of different verbs. There is really only unfolding. Can you step out of concocting things and experience the bigger picture? If so, you begin to get a sense of what the Buddha is talking about when he is talking about nibbana. It's getting beyond fixating on things. Furthermore, stepping beyond sankhara, we have overcome the ignorance of ignoring the much bigger picture of the vastly interrelated world. It's out of ignorance, or avijja, that we concoct all the seemingly separate bits and pieces of reality. This more clearly explains the first pair of links of the 12-link model, sankharas arise dependent on ignorance. If you remember back to the chapter The Noble Quest, there were two important things that needed to be understood. The first one is this-that conditionality, dependent origination. The second important thing at Majjhima Nikaya 26.19, which is also difficult to understand, is, namely, the stilling of all fabrications, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. Now we can understand stilling of all fabrications as a sankata, unconcocted, unfabricated, not fixating on concepts. The relinquishing of all acquisitions is not clinging. The destruction of craving is the end of craving. These lead to dispassion, not having our minds colored by being lost in our concepts. They lead to cessation, of dukkha, to nibbana, liberation. Notice that, although the first important thing, this-that conditionality, dependent origination, does have metaphysical implications as a side effect, this second important thing is all about upgrading your behavior due to the insights gained from a deep understanding of the first important thing. So how do we get there? There's another sutta in the Udana that gives us an actual practice to do. We will examine the fairly famous Bahiya Sutta in the next chapter. Nibbana, as described in the Bahiya Sutta. You should train yourself thus. In seeing, there will be merely seeing. In hearing, there will merely be hearing. In sensing, there will merely be sensing. In cognizing, there will merely be cognizing. The Bahiya Sutta occurs in the first book of the Udana, and it's the 10th sutta in that book, Udana 1.10. Thus have I heard, once the Buddha was living in Savatthi at Jada's Grove on Apindika's Park. Now at that time, Bahiya of the bark cloth was living at Suparaka by the seashore. He was honored as a holy man and had no trouble obtaining alms food, robes, lodgings, and medicine when he was ill. The question arises, why was this holy man wearing bark cloth? The commentaries tell us that he was a shipwrecked sailor who washed up naked at Suparaka, which would be near today's Mumbai. They say he found some bark to cover his nakedness, and when people saw this, they thought he was a holy man and started giving him food, lodgings, etc. But the commentaries were written many centuries after this story takes place and in a different culture, and the authors actually had no idea what happened. Most likely, Bahiya of the bark cloth was a devotee of the Bharad Aranyaka Upanishad, one of the earliest of the Upanishads. The Upanishads are Vedic teachings that originated a century or maybe more before the Buddha. The Vedas themselves are quite ancient, but the later literature in that tradition were these Upanishads. And the Bharad Aranyaka Upanishad, one of the earliest ones, makes a big deal about trees. So Bahiya is dressed like a tree because of his devotion to the Bharad Aranyaka Upanishad. Then one day the thought arose in Bahiya of the bark cloth, am I an arahant, or am I at least on the way to arahantship? Then a deva, who was a relative of Bahiya's in a former life, overheard this thought of Bahiya of the bark cloth. This deva came to Bahiya and said, Bahiya, you are not an arahant, and furthermore, you do not practice a path that could lead to arahantship. Then Bahiya said to that deva, well, who in this world is an arahant or knows a path to arahantship? And that deva replied, in a far country, in the kingdom of Kosala, near the town of Savatthi, there is the Buddha, the perfectly awakened one. He is an arahant, and he teaches a path to arahantship. Then Bahiya of the bark cloth set his lodging in order and immediately departed for Savatthi. He stopped for only one night at each place along the way. In other words, he went directly there. He'd go as far as he could in the day. He would rest for the night, get up the next day, and keep going. He didn't take any rest days. He had samvega, spiritual urgency. Eventually, he arrived at Savatthi and went to Jada's Grove, Anathapindika's park. When he arrived there, he saw a number of monks doing walking meditation. He went up to those monks and inquired, "Venerable sirs, where is the Buddha? Where is the Blessed One, the fully awakened one, the Arahant?" Those monks said to Bahia, "The Blessed One has gone into town on alms round." Straight away, Bahia left Jada's Grove, Anathapindika's park, and headed into Savatthi to find the Buddha. It wasn't long before he encountered the Buddha. He recognized him by his clear, bright countenance and perhaps by the large number of monks following along behind as he went on alms round. Bahia immediately rushed forward and threw himself at the Buddha's feet and said, "Teach me Dhamma, O Blessed One. Teach me Dhamma that it might be for my benefit for a long time." The Buddha replied, "It is an unsuitable time, Bahia. We have entered among the houses for alms food." At that time, if someone got their food by going on alms round, there was a limited time window in which they were able to obtain alms food. People didn't have alms food available all day. They would do their cooking in the morning and with some extra cooked for any recluse or beggar that came by. Then, when all that was gone and they had eaten their own meal, that was the end of the alms food. If you approach someone who got their food by going on alms round and requested a teaching, then if they stopped and gave you a teaching, they might not eat that day. So Bahia is told it's not an appropriate time. Bahia replied, "Teach me Dhamma, O Blessed One. Teach me Dhamma. It is uncertain how long I will live. It is uncertain how long the Blessed One will live. Teach me Dhamma, so it will be for my benefit for a long time." And again the Buddha replied, "It is an unsuitable time, Bahia. We have entered among the houses for alms food." And a third time Bahia said, "Teach me Dhamma, O Blessed One. Teach me Dhamma. It is uncertain how long I will live. It is uncertain how long the Blessed One will live. Teach me Dhamma, O Blessed One, so that it will be for my benefit for a long time." Sometimes if you ask a Buddha three times really nicely, he might grant your wish. Herein, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In seeing, there will merely be seeing. In hearing, there will merely be hearing. In sensing, there will merely be sensing. In cognizing, there will merely be cognizing. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia. When Bahia, for you, in seeing there is merely seeing, in hearing there is merely hearing, in sensing there is merely sensing, and in cognizing there is merely cognizing, then Bahia, you will not be with that. When Bahia, you are not with that, then Bahia, you will not be in that. When Bahia, you are not in that, then Bahia, you will be neither here nor beyond nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of dukkha. Through this brief Dhamma teaching by the Blessed One, the mind of Bahia of the bark cloth was immediately freed from the asavas, or the intoxicants. Then the Blessed One, having instructed Bahia with this brief instruction, went away. Why did the Buddha give this particular teaching to Bahia of the bark cloth? And why did it have such a profound effect? The bark cloth clothing marked Bahia as a serious follower of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So the Buddha could tell that Bahia would be familiar with his Brihadaranyaka Upanishad teaching. The unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the uncognized cognizer. There is no other seer but he, no other hearer, no other thinker, no other cognizer. This is thyself, the inner controller, the immortal. And that he would also be familiar with that imperishable is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the ununderstood understander. Other than it there is not that sees. Other than it there is not that hears. Other than it there is not that thinks. Other than it there is not that understands. The Buddha, as he often does, takes something his questioner is familiar with and gives it a subtle but profound twist. There's no Atman, there's just seeing, just hearing, etc. The Buddha knows Bahia's practice, and he knows Bahia has been looking at his seeing, trying to find the unseen seer, listening to his hearing for the unheard hearer, etc. So he says to him, "No, in seeing, let there just be seeing, in hearing, just hearing, in sensing, just sensing, in cognizing, just cognizing." When you can do that, when there's just seeing, not seeing an object, just seeing, then there's no you in that, there's no you in this. There's no you in between, meaning there's no subject-object duality, Just this is the end of dukkha. Not long after the Blessed One's departure, a cow with a young calf attacked Bahia of the bark cloth and killed him. This seems to have been a common hazard at that time. Today it would be as if someone went to their weekly meditation group and on the way home a drunk driver ran a red light and killed them. Only they didn't have drunk drivers back then, they had cows with calves, and there were no fences, just like today in India. You can imagine Bahia is walking along, and in seeing, he's just seeing. There's a cow over on the left, there's a calf on the left, there's another cow over on the right. The assumption, of course, is that calf on the left goes with that cow on the left. Bahia walks between that calf on the left and that cow on the right, which is the real mama, and oops, he's done in. I say this is a common hazard because Bahia of the bark cloth was not the only person mentioned as being killed by a cow with a calf. There was the former king of Taxila, who renounced his kingship and traveled to Rajagaha to become a Buddhist monk. He actually encountered the Buddha one night in a potter's shed, and the Buddha gave him a discourse during which he attained the third level of awakening. But before he could reach final arahantship, he was killed by a cow with calf. There's also the story of Supabuddha the leper, who saw a large gathering of people. Thinking it may be a free distribution of food, he went to the gathering. But no, it was just someone giving a talk. But Supabuddha sat down to listen anyway. It was the Buddha, and he gave a Dhamma talk, and Supabuddha the leper attained the first level of awakening. But he too was killed by a cow with calf. One of the Vinaya stories talks about the public executioner in King Pasenadi's kingdom of Kosala with its capital at Savatthi. This executioner was also killed by a cow with calf. The commentaries, bless their little hearts, say it was all the same cow, despite the fact that these took place in widely separated areas. Supposedly, in a previous life, these four guys had hired a courtesan, had their way with her, and then killed her. Now she had come back as a cow and killed them. Be careful when studying the commentaries. A cow with calf just was a hazard at that time, and poor Bahia got caught in the hazard. When the Blessed One, having walked for alms food in Savatthi, was returning from alms round with a number of bhikkhus, on departing from the town, he saw that Bahia of the bark cloth had died. Seeing this, he said to the bhikkhus, "Bhikkhus, take Bahia's body, put it on a litter carrying it away, burn it, and make a stupa for it. Your companion in the holy life has died." "Very well, venerable sir," those bhikkhus replied to the Blessed One, and they did so. When they were done, they went to the Blessed One, prostrated themselves, sat down to one side, and told him what they'd done, adding, "What is his destiny? What is his future birth?" Bhikkhus, Bahia of the bark cloth was a wise man. He practiced according to the Dhamma and did not trouble me by disputing about Dhamma. Bhikkhus, Bahia of the bark cloth has attained final Nibbana. Then on realizing its significance, the Blessed One uttered on that occasion this inspired utterance. "Where neither water, nor earth, nor fire, nor air gain a foothold, there gleam no stars, no sun sheds light. There shines no moon, yet there no darkness reigns." When a sage, a Brahmin, has come to know this for themselves through their own wisdom, then they are freed from form and formless, freed from pleasure, freed from pain, freed from pain. As in Udana 8.1, we are going beyond the four elements, where water, earth, fire, and air gain no foothold. We are going beyond rupa, going beyond projecting concepts of solid, liquid, gas, and energy onto the material world, going beyond light and dark, going beyond form and formless. One is freed from form, freed from formless, and also freed from pleasure, freed from pain. This, just this, is the end of dukkha. Once again, the Buddha is talking about what we now call non-duality. This non-duality initially is in respect to materiality, not concocting or fabricating in our minds tables and chairs and trees and cows and calves and everything else that is material. Then, also not concocting light and dark, not even concocting pleasure and pain, just this is the end of dukkha. We are now beginning to get a sense that Nibbana is a way of experiencing the world differently from the way we usually experience it. In the sutta, the Buddha gives a method that can enable us to begin to have these experiences. In seeing, let there just be seeing. In hearing, just hearing. In sensing, just sensing. In cognizing, just cognizing. If you can do that, if you can actually step into the non-dual state, if you can get beyond subject and object, then there is no you in that, no you in this, no you in between. There's nothing to grab hold of. There's no craving because there's no craver and nothing to be craved. Just this is the end of dukkha. This Bahia practice is actually quite an important practice and is particularly good to do when going for a walk. Can you just walk along and just see seeing and just hear hearing? In the sensing of the road or trail, there's just sensing. When it's going really well, it doesn't feel like you're walking along the road. When it's going really well, your sense of vision is sort of bouncing a bit with each step, and the road is passing away underneath your vision, and that's all that is happening. There are sounds, but you don't identify them as a bird or anything else. You're not seeing that as a tree. There are just colored shapes in your visual field. There are just sounds, and there are physical sensations, and the whole thing is changing as you walk along. Now step back a bit further to where there are not even colored shapes, not even sounds, just seeing and just hearing. It is possible to step out of the concocting, the fabricating that we are usually doing, our normal busting up the world into a whole bunch of bits and pieces. It's also possible to stop finding the best piece and saying it's me, and the second best piece is mine. When you can stop doing that, you stop doing the craving and clinging, and there's no more dukkha. For more on this non-ordinary way of sensing the world, there's another sutta on this same point, which we will examine in the next chapter. Nibbana, as described in Digha Nikaya 11. Where consciousness is signless, limitless, and all-illuminating. Digha Nikaya 11.85. The Kavada Sutta, in the long discourses, the Digha Nikaya, is another sutta like Majjhima Nikaya 38 that appears to have been created by joining two different discourses together. Both of the discourses that make up Digha Nikaya 11 were given to the layman Kavada, who lived in the city of Nalanda. Nalanda is just north of Rajagaha, the capital of the kingdom of Magadha. The Buddha's chief disciple, Sariputta, was a native of Nalanda. Nalanda was later the site of a famous Buddhist university which was destroyed in the Muslim invasion of the late 12th century of the Common Era. At this time, Kavada came to the Buddha, saluted him, sat down at one side and said, "Venerable sir, this Nalanda is a prosperous place. It is full of rich people, much grain, lots of wealth. You should send some of your monks into town to perform miracles. If you do that, the people of Nalanda will be very impressed, and they'll give you food, clothing, lodgings, and medicine if needed." The Buddha replied, "Kavada, this is not how we teach the Dhamma. There are really only three miracles. There is the miracle of the super normal powers. This refers to being one and becoming many, being many and becoming one, appearing and disappearing, walking on water, diving through the earth, passing through walls and ramparts unimpeded, flying cross-legged through the air, all the usual stuff. There are these supernormal powers, but as everyone knows, there is the Gandhara charm that allows anyone to do this. If the monks were to go into Nalanda and perform these sorts of miracles, the people of Nalanda would say, 'Oh, they've got a Gandhara charm.' No one would be particularly impressed. There's also a second miracle, and that's knowing the minds of others. But if the monks were to go into town and perform mind reading, everyone knows that there's the Manika charm. If you possess the Manika charm, then you can know the minds of others, and people will just say, 'Ah, they've got a Manika charm,' and no one would be particularly impressed. There is only one miracle that is actually impressive, the miracle of instruction. And what is the miracle of instruction? A Tathagata arises in this world, a fully awakened Buddha who teaches the Dhamma which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Someone hears the Dhamma, gains confidence, goes forth, practices the precepts, guards the senses, is mindful of their activities, is content with little, abandons the hindrances, practices the jhanas, gains insight into the nature of reality, overcomes the asavas, and becomes completely awakened. This is the miracle of instruction." The series above, actually given in far more detail in the sutta, is the gradual training, which occurs in various forms in 30 different suttas. It appears to be the curriculum of practice for the monks and nuns in the Buddha's monastic sangha. The gradual training is another example of the general principle of dependent origination, with each item arising and becoming perfected dependent on the previous items. This is the end of the first discourse in this sutta, which then continues with a quite different story. Once in this order, Kivada, there was a monk who wanted to know where the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, cease without remainder. So he attained to such a great level of concentration that he was able to go to the lowest of the heavens, the devas of the four great kings. He went up to the devas there and said, "Excuse me, good sirs, can you please tell me where the four elements cease without remainder?" Those devas said to that monk, "We don't know, but you should ask the four great kings. They'll probably know." So that monk increased his concentration, was able to reappear in the presence of the four great kings. He went up to those four great kings and said, "Excuse me, good sirs, can you tell me where the four elements cease without remainder?" And they said to him, "We don't know, but if you ask the devas in the realm above this one, maybe they will know." So that monk increased his concentration and went up to the next realm. There he approached those devas. You might guess how this story unfolds. Up and up he went through the heavens, at each level asking, "Where do the four elements cease without remainder?" And at each level, the devas replied, "We don't know. Ask the guys upstairs." Up he went through the heavens, one after another, until finally he reached the retinue of Brahma. He approaches those devas and asks, "Excuse me, good sirs, can you please tell me where the four elements cease without remainder?" And those devas said to him, "We don't know, but you should ask Brahma. He knows everything." The monk asks, "Where can I find this Brahma?" "Oh, no one knows where to find Brahma." "Well, how can I ask him?" "Sometimes he shows up, and then you can ask him." "Well, how will I know when he shows up?" "Oh, you'll know. There will be a bright light, and a sound like thunder, and lots of sweet-smelling incense, and Brahma will appear and announce himself." So that monk went over to a corner and sat down to meditate. It wasn't too long until there was a bright light, and a sound like thunder, and lots of sweet-smelling incense, and Brahma appeared and announced in a loud voice, "I am Brahma, creator of the universe, lord of all. I know everything. I see everything." That monk went up to him and said, "Excuse me, sir, can you tell me where the four elements cease without remainder?" Brahma replied, "I am Brahma, creator of the universe, lord of all. I know everything. I see everything." "I didn't ask you who you were. You already told me that. Can you tell me where the four elements cease without remainder?" "I am Brahma, creator of the universe, lord of all. I know everything. I see everything." "Look, you already told me that. Stop repeating yourself and just tell me where the four elements cease without remainder." Then Brahma took that monk by the arm and led him aside and said, "These guys think I know everything. I don't know where the four elements cease without remainder. But by the looks of you, you are a Buddhist monk. Why don't you go ask the Buddha?" So as quickly as a strong man could extend his arm or draw it back, that monk disappeared from the Brahma realm and reappeared on earth. He went to the Blessed One, saluted him, sat down at one side and said, "Venerable sir, where do the four elements cease without remainder?" The Buddha replied, "You've been wandering around as far as the Brahma realm asking this question, and now not finding it, you come back to me. But monk, you should not ask your question in that way. Where do the four elements cease without remainder? Instead, this is how the question should be put. Where do earth, water, fire, and air no footing find? Where do long and short, small and great, beautiful and ugly, where do name and form completely come to an end? And the answer is, where consciousness is signless, limitless, and all-illuminating. That's where earth, water, fire, and air no footing find. There, both long and short, small and great, beautiful and ugly, their name and form all come to an end. With the cessation of consciousness, all this comes to an end." This is a bit cryptic. The wrong question is, where do the four elements cease without remainder? The right question is, where do the four elements no footing find? This harkens back to the verses after the Bahiya Sutta, where the Buddha says, where the four elements no footing find, there dark and light don't occur. Here he expands the teaching to say it's where consciousness is signless, limitless, and all-illuminating. When you see a table, you're seeing the signs of a table. It's got a flat top and legs holding it up off the ground. That's how you know it's a table. You pick up the cues, the signs. So what does it mean that consciousness is signless? How about a consciousness that is, well, in seeing is just seeing, in hearing is just hearing, in sensing is just sensing, in cognizing is just cognizing? How about a consciousness that is not fabricating, not concocting a table, not giving birth to a table, not making this a table? It's a way of experiencing the world without fixating in any way on the objects or characteristics of any object being sensed, or on the one doing the sensing. It's looking at the world from a non-dual perspective. Nibbana is not a thing. It doesn't have ontological existence. It's a realization. It's a realization that there is nothing but streams of dependently originated processes interacting without even making a thing out of the streams. If you concoct stream, you still have not quite gotten all the way to the point. Everything is not a thing. It's just dependent on other things which aren't things. It's a little hard to talk about. You can see why the Buddha says it's not this and it's not that. It's consciousness that is signless. But it's not just your ordinary open awareness, which is also a form of consciousness that is signless. Indeed, open awareness, Bahia practice, is certainly helpful in gaining this realization. But the realization of Nibbana does seem to require a breakthrough to a much deeper understanding, an understanding that is so profound that it permanently changes the way you experience the world. The best, totally inadequate simile I can offer is to ask you to remember what it was like when you found out there was no Santa Claus. And apologies to those of you who never believed in Santa Claus, it is an inadequate simile. I remember I saw the world differently. There was fear. Fear I wouldn't be getting any more of those really premium Christmas presents. But there also was a different way of seeing the world and of relating to the big guy in the red suit. The world wasn't any different, but I was. The breakthrough experience of Nibbana is a realization so profound it permanently changes you and your relationship to the world, and a very important component of what is experienced is signless consciousness. When consciousness is signless, it's also limitless. There can't be any limits because a limit would be a sign. You're not concocting the end of this consciousness. It really is all-encompassing and it's all-illuminating. When viewing from this viewpoint, when realizing in this way, nothing is hidden. Everything is experienced to be dependent on other things. Nothing stands alone, and nothing is a thing. It's all verbs. It's all processes, but they aren't individual processes. One gets this huge, giant picture of, I guess you could say, unfolding. Not the unfolding, because that makes it a noun, a thing. There's just unfolding. Can you experience the world like that? Can you experience the inconstant, unsatisfactory, empty nature of phenomena without resorting on dualities or even signs? Then your consciousness is signless, limitless, and all-illuminating. That's where earth, water, fire, and air no footing find. There, long and short, small and great, beautiful and ugly, their name and form all come to an end. The last line is really puzzling. With the cessation of consciousness, all this comes to an end. Does that mean you have to become unconscious? The usual explanation is that, at a path moment, a momentary experience of Nibbana, there's a cessation experience where everything stops, then it starts up again, only it's really different on the other side. That turns out not to be what's being talked about here, because the idea of path moments is from the later commentaries, and this is a sutta. The word vijnana, which we translate as consciousness, literally means divided knowing. When divided knowing comes to an end, all these dualities come to an end. When we stop chopping up the holistic unfolding into bits and pieces, then all this comes to an end. As Udana 8.1 says, just this is the end of dukkha. This required holistic experience is expressed so very eloquently by Kitaro Nishida in his work, The Nothingness Beyond God. Pure experience is the beginning of Zen. It is awareness stripped of all thought, all conceptualization, all categorization, and all distinctions between subject as having an experience and experience as having been had by a subject. It is prior to all judgment. Pure experience is without all distinction. It is pure nothingness, pure no this or that. It is empty of any and all distinctions. It is absolutely no thing at all. Yet its emptiness and nothingness is a chock-a-block fullness, for it is all experience to come. It is rose, child, river, anger, death, pain, rocks, and cicada sounds. We carve these discrete events and entities out of a richer yet non-distinct manifold of pure experience. Emptiness, mindfulness, selflessness. Of course, the Buddha taught much more than just dependent origination. The most widely known of his teachings, at least in the 21st century West, is mindfulness. What he taught on mindfulness is far deeper than is generally discussed in today's secular mindfulness movement. Thankfully, there are a number of excellent modern books on what the Buddha taught as mindfulness practice. There is also a short, little-known sutta that seems to capture the relationship partnership of dependent origination and mindfulness. It's again from the Sutta Nipata, this time from Book 5, another collection of early suttas. This is Sutta Nipata 5.15. Mogaraja Manavapuka, that is, Mogaraja's question. The word empty in this sutta does not have exactly the same meaning for the Buddha as it has for Nagarjuna. It would be closer to empty of a self and what belongs to a self, or empty of concocted things. We can glean the first of these understandings from Sutta Nipata 35.85. The world is empty. There, Ananda says to the Buddha, "It is said, Venerable Sir, that the world is empty. In what way is it said that the world is empty?" The world is empty of a self and of what belongs to a self. Thus, it is said, the world is empty. But what is empty of self and of what belongs to self? The eye is empty of self and of what belongs to self. Forms are empty of self and of what belongs to self. Eye consciousness is empty of self and what belongs to self. Eye contact is empty of self and of what belongs to self. Whatever Vedana arises with eye contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that too is empty of self and of what belongs to self. The same is then repeated for the ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes, body and textures, and mind and mental objects. Notice that this sutta states forms are empty, anticipating the later Heart Sutra by many years. The second understanding as empty of concocted things can be gleaned from Majjhima Nikaya 121, the smaller sutta on emptiness. There Ananda wants to know what the Buddha means when he says, "These days I often practice the meditation on emptiness." The Buddha replies by providing instructions for a gradual descent to a mind state empty of concoctions. By way of example, he points out that the meditation hall is empty of the disturbances of village life. The forest is empty of the disturbances of the meditation hall. By not attending to the perception of forest, one can focus on singleness based on the perception of earth, and then there are no disturbances of forest. By not attending to the perception of earth, one focuses in turn on singleness based on each of the four immaterial states, dropping one and moving on to the even more subtle next one. One regards each of these meditation states as empty of whatever is not there, and for whatever remains, one understands. There is this. Finally, not attending to the perception of any quality of any of the previous objects, one attends to the singleness based on the signless concentration of mind, which would be resting in the Bahia practice without distraction. Then there is only the non-emptiness connected with the six sensory spheres, dependent on this very body and conditioned by life. This is one's genuine, undistorted, pure descent into emptiness, supreme and unsurpassed. If one can deeply realize that even the signless concentration of mind is concocted and mentally fashioned, and drop that, one becomes liberated. There is far more to this profound sutta than in this very brief summary. Both of these sutta understandings, empty of a self and what belongs to it, and empty of concocted things, fit the Buddha's answer to Magaraja, as does Nagarjuna's empty of essence and dependently originated. But all of these will arise from viewing the world from a soda pie perspective. Whatever understanding you plug in for empty, we have three of the keystones of the Dhamma: emptiness, mindfulness, selflessness. Mogaraja, how should one view the world so that one is not seen by the king of death? The Buddha replies, "View the world as empty, ever mindful. Uproot the view of self. Thus you may be one who overcomes death. So, viewing the world, one is not seen by the king of death." Viewing the world as empty and uprooting the view of self is what we have been discussing in this book, so hopefully nothing further needs to be said here about these. But the ever-mindful phrase packs considerable more power than is usually found in the 21st century secular mindfulness teachings. Modern neuroscience has identified the default mode network, DMN, that is activated in our brains when we are not focusing on an external task. It is a large-scale brain network that ties together several areas of the brain that seem to be active when we are generating a sense of self. The Wikipedia article on the DMN says, it is best known for being active when a person is not focused on the outside world and the brain is at wakeful rest, such as during daydreaming and mind wandering. Other times that the DMN is active include when the individual is thinking about others, thinking about themselves, remembering the past, and planning for the future. If the above description of the DMN sounds like the opposite of mindfulness and more like papancha, you begin to get a sense of what the Buddha is talking about when he says to be ever mindful, rather than our usual way of being lost in papancha. Basically, in addition to viewing the world as empty, which would include not being fooled by your conceptualizing, we need a new default, one superior to the DMN, and that would be being ever mindful. When there is no task at hand that needs your full attention, which of course also requires mindfulness, then just be fully mindful of your current sensory input, continuously mindful of the here and now, rather than wandering off into papancha. This combination of emptiness and being ever mindful is our method for not getting fooled by our conceptualizing and for engaging with the world as it is actually manifesting. Don't be fooled by your conceptualizing. Conceptualization is indeed the source of papancha, or obsessive proliferation. Suttanipata 4.11. Back in the chapter The Key, I mentioned there's more after name and form in Suttanipata 4.11, the discourse on quarrels and disputes. Let's look at that now that we have gained some deeper understanding from the material we studied in the previous chapters. In Suttanipata 4.11, after sense contacts are said to be dependent on name and form, the following question arises. In what state must one be for form to vanish, and what will make pleasure and pain disappear? This is different from what's gone before in that sutta. All the other questions were of the style, what does X depend on? But here the question is not, what do name and form depend on, but how does form disappear? The answer is a bit cryptic. Neither perceiving ordinary perceptions, nor misperceiving perceptions, nor unable to perceive, nor having perception destroyed, maintaining oneself in this way, forms do not occur, because obsessive proliferations have perception as origin. This is the key verse of the sutta, but it is a little unclear exactly how we should translate understand it. Sanya is usually translated as perception. However, perhaps a more accurate translation would be conceptualization. When there is a sensory input, we conceptualize that input, which then provides us with the name identification of that input. Unfortunately, we believe those concepts to be real, to be a totally accurate reflection of the underlying reality, and this is what gets us into trouble. Here the Buddha is not saying we should operate without concepts or that all concepts are false. He's indicating that we need to not be fooled by our conceptualizing. Thus, translating this verse again, we have, one's conceptualization of concepts is not the ordinary kind, nor is one's conceptualization of concepts abnormal. One is not without conceptualization, nor is one's conceptualization of that which has ended to such a one form disappears. Conceptualization is indeed the source of papancha, or obsessive proliferation. This is pointing to the same disappearance of form, as in where neither water, nor earth, nor fire, nor air gain a foothold, found in Digha Nikaya 11, Udana 1.10, and also in Udana 8.1, because form is defined in the suttas as these four elements. So for form to disappear, our perception, our conceptualization must become non-ordinary, exactly what the instructions to Bahia provide. The insights into our conceptualizing that are gained from Bahia's practice check our tendency towards obsessive proliferation, which can lead to craving and clinging, and those too are a setup for dukkha. It's important to remember that dependent origination, emptiness, and sotapai are all empty and are just concepts, None of them is ultimate. None of them is metaphysics, even if they do have metaphysical implications as side effects. They are just useful concepts intended to help us escape from our ordinary way of conceiving the world. In particular, sotapi, streams of dependently arising processes interacting, is not any final word. Once you have grokked sotapi, it's then necessary to step back even further and realize that the processes are only concepts, and also that the streams are just concepts. Each time we conceive of a process, we are beginning to lose sight of all the other processes in that stream. Each time we conceive of a stream, we are beginning to lose sight of all the other streams that particular stream is entangled with. It's not that all the processes are connected to all the other processes, nor that all the streams are connected to all the other streams. It's that all of these are interconnected to so many other streams and processes that the full picture leaves us with only indivisible unfolding. It's like a net. Each node of the net is not directly connected to every other node, but each node is connected to enough other nodes such that all the nodes form a unitary object, the net. But invisible unfolding is also not like a net, in that a net is a static thing and indivisible unfolding is totally dynamic. From Pointing Out the Great Way by Dan Brown. It is incorrect to say that phenomena come forth either as discrete temporal events or as an emergent mass. Both positions are extreme. The events are neither one or many. It's an ultimate sense these conceptualizations are empty. Yet, in a relative sense, it may seem both as if many single mind moments occur and as if there is one entire interconnected network of very subtle propensities. As Nagarjuna said, it is all at ease, not conceptualizable by mental conceptualizing, incommunicable, inconceivable, indivisible. There is no ultimate concept possible. The indivisible universe is incommunicable and inconceivable, but without intuiting the sublime, you cannot experience freedom. It is necessary to intuit the ultimate. This is exactly what dependent origination, emptiness, and sotapi are all pointing at. They are concepts that attempt to point us towards the incommunicable, inconceivable, indivisible ultimate reality. Once we do intuit the ultimate deeply enough, we can become disenchanted with things of the conventional world. They are experienced as just concepts, necessary concepts for navigating conventional reality, but they no longer color our minds such that our mental proliferation leads to craving and clinging. Furthermore, we can begin to act more in harmony with the ultimate nature of reality. This does not mean we are living without concepts. One is not without conceptualization. It just means we are not being fooled by our concepts. In particular, it means we don't lose sight of the indivisible nature of reality. At the conventional level, this means striving to live in harmony with all the things of the conventional world, because they and you are all vastly interrelated. So how does one do that? The second item of the Buddha's Eightfold Path is right intention, which the Buddha defines as intentions of renunciation, intentions of non-ill will, intentions of harmlessness. Or we could say letting go, love, and compassion. We can let go because we have deeply experienced there is nothing that can be hung on to. It's all in flux. And we can act with love and compassion because we have deeply experienced the interrelated, indivisible nature of reality. These three are natural responses to experiencing deeply the dynamic, holistic nature of the world. All three arise because we are no longer trapped into believing our conceptualizing will yield the full picture of the world. In particular, the concepts of me and mine are seen as just concepts, and the less driven we are by these two concepts, the more freedom we find. From Albert Einstein, a human being is part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. The striving to free oneself from this delusion is the one issue of true religion. Not to nourish the delusion, but to try to overcome it, is the way to reach the attainable measure of peace of mind. And from Martin Luther King, Jr., all I'm saying is simply this, that all mankind is tied together. All life is interrelated, and we are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be, and you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of reality. Letting go, love, and compassion are the natural response to experiencing deeply the all-pervasive, interrelated, dependently arising nature of our world. Don't be fooled by your conceptualizing. Afterward. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. From Majjhima Nikaya 28.28. This book is an attempt to show what the deepest understanding of right view is and how to work with it. Start examining the world in light of the ideas presented here. It's all just soda pie, just streams of dependently arising processes interacting. Plus, the streams are vastly interrelated. Viewing the world from this perspective and acting in harmony with what you find is a very important part of the path of practice. Just don't get fooled by your conceptualizing while doing this or doing anything else either. But this book only contains a description, just fingers pointing at the sublime. The ultimate nature of the universe has to be experienced for yourself. It is unattainable by mere reasoning. It is subtle to be experienced by the wise. For this information to be anything more than an intellectual grab bag, you have to practice. You have to do this investigation for yourself. You have to examine reality with an indistractable mind from this perspective until you experience the full implications of this-that conditionality, dependent origination, for yourself. This book is also incomplete. Only a fully realized person could fully understand dependent origination, and then, of course, could not fully describe it, since the ultimate is indescribable. But there is more than can be described, certainly more than can be described than is described in this book. I'm sure that if I attempted to write down all the nuances and depths that even I have encountered, this would be a never-ending task. The more I look closely, the more I find to explore. But hopefully what's here is sufficient to give you both a starting point and inspiration to do your own exploration of dependent origination. Had I written this book a decade earlier, it would have been quite different. Nothing stays the same. Everything in the universe is in flux, especially unenlightened human ideas and understandings. But what is presented here is based on my current understanding of the Buddha's teaching of dependent origination. This 2,500-year-old tradition's teachings are both practical and timely even today. Perhaps by the time you have this book in hand, my understanding will have deepened. Maybe if I'm diligent, it will have deepened enough that I see this as just a waypoint along the path. Maybe this book will serve as a useful waypoint on your path. May your journey on the spiritual path be of great fruit and great benefit to you and to all beings. The real afterword. Recognize the interrelatedness of all of us and act accordingly.